The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center, Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the monthly Guest Dharma series.
So welcome again, everybody. We're pleased to have Wendy back speaking. Probably a lot of you know Wendy Moore. She's one of the longer-term people in our community, probably since almost the beginning time. 1990, the ancient times, and both a leader with the Twin Cities Vipassana Collective, one of the Buddhist groups in town, and of course here at Common Ground and various teaching and leadership roles, and also more generally in the Buddhist community in town. And Wendy, I remember once said to me something like, I've never met a form I wasn't inspired to go beyond. I thought, oh, that is really great. You remember that?
No.
Oh, yeah.
What does it mean?
I probably just kind of explain that tonight. But I know it has something to do with freedom. You know, not being trapped by forms. And one of the things in Wendy's varied career of being an artist and a community organizer, among other things, is now getting involved in the relationship between the arts and leadership development. And when I originally asked Wendy back in the spring of last year to give a talk, you know, I was thinking some people with young kids had asked, well, why don't you get Wendy to talk again about, you know, being a parent? And then, so I suggested that to Wendy, and she was saying, well, it's bigger than that. You know, it's really about how to bring the practice into the world. So that's really, I think, somewhat what our talk will be about tonight. But it's called An Untitled Talk, Expressing the Dharma in Contemporary Art, Leadership, Parenting, and Other Forms of Creative Engagement. So thanks, Wendy, for coming.
We can talk about that later. Is this on? That might have been the contemporary art part of the talk. And for those of you who are listening in the future, I just stood up with my hands clenched, and then I opened them, and there were two crusts of bread in my hands, and I almost ate one. I think it was about 10 years ago, Mark, when you first asked me to talk at Common Ground. And I was, we were having a conversation about what I might speak about. And I remember you said, well, just talk about how you're practicing right now. And that's been the guideline that I've used whenever I'm invited to speak. So how is it that I'm practicing right now, these days? And preparing for this evening has just been a very precious opportunity for me to reflect alone and now to reflect out loud with you all on exactly how I am practicing these days. And I'm grateful that you're here and I'm here. And when I say these days, perhaps you've noticed, as I have, that the spiritual life seems to have seasons. It goes in seasons. And there have been seasons when I've approached my practice with a kind of very private rigor, when my primary engagement was with my sitting cushion and my heart and my mind. And those seasons looked like many hours sitting on the cushion, long periods of silent retreat practice, sitting, walking, sitting, walking, walking, sitting. So those of you who've done more retreat practice know that rhythm. And then there have been other seasons of my spiritual life that look more like this one, where I have been very engaged in this big outer floating world, when there's lots of activity and lots of groups of people, really practicing mindfulness off the cushion and on the fly. So when I gave the untitle for this talk to Mark last summer, it was really an intuitive choice. And I asked myself, so how am I practicing these days? And these different phrases sort of floated to the surface. Creative engagement, leadership, contemporary art, parenting, expressing the Dharma. But although I had an intuitive sense of the interrelationship of those different dimensions of my life, my hope was that by giving this talk, I would actually get more explicit for you and for myself about what those interconnections are. And so that's what I hope to discover with you tonight. I'd like to start talking about the Dharma part of expressing the Dharma, and especially for people here who may not be familiar with that term. Dharma is a Sanskrit word, and I looked it up on Wikipedia, and this was great. It said that it has something like many lively layers of meaning. I thought that was, and that how there are so many different dimensions to that word that in some ways many of us English speakers have just incorporated it into our language. That it refers both to the teachings of the Buddha and also to the nature of reality, how things are. So it's a recognition that things change, a recognition that there's no fixed and lasting thing that's going to make us permanently happy, and that who we are is really a changing process rather than a fixed persona. That many of my movement teachers have said over the years that we are more verbs than nouns. The root of the word Dharma is der, which means to hold or support. It's commonly translated as law, which is really a very inadequate translation. And my first teacher was, meditation teacher, was Shinzen Yang. And Shinzen and I both speak Chinese. So at certain times during interviews, when Shinzen would have trouble communicating something that he wanted to share with me, he would switch into Chinese. And the Chinese word for Dharma is Fa. And Shinzen, he described to me that the gateway over his monastery in Japan was inscribed with these ancient Chinese characters. And they read, Yi Shan. Yi is using or with. Shan, as in Shanti, is the body. So with the body. Shuo Fa. Shuo is express or speak. Fa is Dharma. What the Buddha taught, the way things are, this current reality, the path to freedom. Yi Shan Shuo Fa. And I think those characters for many years were just inscribed in my own spiritual practice with embodied action express the Dharma. And this evening I want to speak a little bit about what it might mean to express the Dharma in three arenas of my life. And these are arenas that really invite me to be awake and that really challenge me to Yi Shan Shuo Fa. And these are leadership and parenting, which I really see as two facets of the same form of engagement. And contemporary art, which in at its best for me, it's really kind of a wild and luscious opportunity to experience the world in some really new and fresh way. Here's the caveat for this evening, that I'm very aware of the pitfalls of attempting to talk about spiritual practice in the context of leadership or contemporary art or even parenting, because these are some pretty thick concepts. And if you're anything like me, it's really easy to get lost in concepts and to miss out on the lived reality of leadership, what it's like to be in a group of people who are trying to create something together or move something forward, or make some change. The lived reality of contemporary art, in my experience, is some fresh aesthetic, sense-based making something or perceiving something. Or the lived reality of parenting, just holding my daughter's hand in my hand, and it's still smaller than mine. And it won't always be, but it still is. So, I think the real name for this talk, in some ways, should have just been an untitled talk. And I chose that phrase, an untitled. And I was thinking about artists who don't title their work. And I don't think it's because they're lazy. And I don't think it's because they don't understand what they're doing. I think they're inviting us to have a direct experience with what they made, an experience that is not mediated by the concept or the idea or the weight of a title. So by not assigning a conceptual frame, we invite one another to dive directly into the experience itself. So I was just curious, what it was like when I just stood up and started doing that for you. And I'm curious if anyone wants to say anything about what you noticed in that moment when I stood up and I just started doing that.
Well, it sounded like you were trying to communicate, you were communicating something, but you were also giving it up to us to interpret.
So
adding words to it, that's for sure.
So communicating something, but leaving it up to you to interpret without words. Yeah. Thank you.
I'm a past man, so I was like, I don't know if you had some tradition you got to do before you speak.
So maybe it's a ritual, a Vipassana ritual that everybody does, is they get up and they squeeze their hands and they open them up and then they almost eat a piece of bread. Okay, yeah. It's not a Zen tradition, no. Yeah.
It almost was like a moderate dance kind of movement where it looked like it was a call to engagement. It was like, okay, don't just engage with eyes and ears. You have to engage on some other level. There's something else going to be happening here. It felt like a call to engagement.
A call to engagement, kind of like a modern dance, like inviting you to engage on some level that isn't just your eyes and ears. Yeah.
The first thing that I had two responses, but the first thing I noticed was that when you stood up to it, at the beginning it seemed like you were slightly uncomfortable, slightly self-conscious. Mm-hmm. And then as you started to move, then you were into what you were trying to say, into your meaning more.
Yes.
So I was able to just pay more attention to it as you start to move and see more of the dance thing. And then the other thing, I wasn't sure what you had in your hand. I wasn't sure what it is that you were almost eating, and I thought it might be a stone.
So what was I almost eating? And that you noticed the progression of my own sort of discomfort and then opening into something. So that you some kind of transformation as you're watching. Yeah. That affected your experience. So whatever was in my hands had been shaped by them.
I've been working with clay today, so I thought you were hoping clay actually.
So the context that we bring determines, influences what we perceive. Yeah.
I was
so much
struck by. I thought they were stones too.
Mm-hmm.
But I was struck by you stood up and you presented yourself to God, and I thought I couldn't ever do that. And then I was struck by the fact that you had this childlike instance, and I know you're a grown woman and adult. Wow, that's really cool. You know, so that's what I was struck by, was that you had this presence that was open, like a child's heart is open, like this is what I'm going to do now.
So the first thing, it sounds like there was sort of almost like an evaluation of, oh, what would this mean if I were to do, what would this be like for me to do this? And then an association of this kind of childlike, and then an evaluation. That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a whole lot of stuff.
A whole lot of, yeah.
I wasn't going to say anything, because it's nothing very profound. I didn't have profound feelings, but I felt uncomfortable. And I wouldn't have said anything, maybe. Hadn't been quite out. I don't know that you appeared to be uncomfortable. Maybe that's what I was just empathizing with or something. I just kind of had an uncomfortable feeling of him stood up there and did this, and I don't know why.
So there was some discomfort, and what was me, what I was transmitting, what was, it's like unknown, just this, the flavor of your experience, your felt experience.
I had a similar experience of feeling uncomfortable because I know how Dharma talks are supposed to look.
That wasn't it.
Yes. How little it takes to disorient us.
And I got excited because all of a sudden there was a shift. So when you stood up, I started smiling. Because there's been a shift away from talking.
Something
else. The fact that I didn't know what you did or what it meant, I loved
you even more. So the shift was, and the risk and the not knowing was exciting for you.
There's something similar to just that edge between fear and excitement and heightened awareness, both out of fear but also out of interest, like what's going to happen.
Along with that, too, I was totally engaged. I was totally engaged. You know, because I just completed all this kind of meditation. So then, in there, it was just like, oh my God. I think I might complete attention.
Thank you. I'm just digesting all that. This is. I think that is the contemporary art part of the evening. I think you just made the link, the links, many links. I was thinking about Michael Cunningham, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist, wrote these sentences in his book, The Hours. Everything in the world has its own secret name, a name that cannot be conveyed in language, but is simply the sight and feel of the thing itself. So what is the secret name of this? The sight and feel of the thing itself. The secret name of this. I just clenched my hand and put my bread in my mouth. I heard this story recently, and I don't know if it's true, but I guess it doesn't matter, because I think a lot of great stories are true in essence, if not in fact. It was a story about some of the sisters who work with Mother Teresa. And the sisters brought a dying man in from the streets of Calcutta. And although the man was very silent and his body was very limp, his fists were clenched as very, very tight, tight and shut. The sisters encouraged the man to open the grasp of his hands And when he didn't respond, they began to gently pry his fingers open. And as they did, they glimpsed something hidden in his hands. And there, inside each palm, was a crust of bread. Well, they took the crust of bread to Mother Teresa, and they asked her, "What should we do with these?" To which Mother Teresa replied, "We honor them." Sometime after hearing this story, I came home, and Eli, who some of you know, it's Mara and William's son, Eli, who's my daughter's babysitter, was there. And Eli's a drummer, and I asked him if he would be a hand model for me. And there at the table, we started reenacting the opening of those two clenched fists, and I began to snap some photographs. And as soon as Eli's hands were fully open, it was suddenly apparent to me that he was in the position to receive something. So I reached across the table spontaneously to a vase of flowers, and I plucked two flowers, and I put each one, one in each of his palms. And with that action, I affirmed what is a very obvious yet essential reality about how things work, which is that when our hands are not clenched tight, we're receptive to receive something new, something fresh, something unexpected. And I've been thinking a lot since that moment about what are the metaphor crusts of bread that I'm holding on to in the clenched, tight-fisted places in my own heart and mind. So the story has become an invitation for me to reflect on the assumptions, the beliefs, the attitudes in a single moment that I'm clinging to that promise more nourishment than they actually deliver. And also thinking about what might it mean to honor what I'm clinging to, even as opening is happening and letting go is happening. So like my hands, when my mind is clenched and closed shut around a particular assumption, I'm limited in my ability to receive something fresh and unexpected. And yet even just a little bit of letting go, when it happens in my own heart and mind, there's a natural abundance of creative responses that's suddenly available. So in other words, there's a direct correlation between what we usually talk about in rooms like this as non-grasping or as non-attachment and creative engagement. When my hands or my heart and mind are open, I'm ready to engage creatively. And what I mean by that is without a preconceived or premeditated or prescripted canned response, a habitual response. I'm receptive to a creative response that's generated by authentically engaging with this particular moment. An example is, I can't tell you how many times a week when I find myself just about to enter into a argument or a power struggle with my daughter, Izzy, who's 9, and I quietly, almost subliminally, ask myself, what am I holding on to right now that's contributing to this struggle? And is it necessary or helpful for me to be clinging like this? And then, next moment, I let myself really feel what that clinging feels like. And to feel the tension that it produces within me and within my relationship with Izzy. And if I look closely enough, there's almost always some tenacious belief or something lurking about that has to do with what I assume about how parents and children should interact. And it could be some vestige from my own childhood or something left over from the 18th century about how children should be obedient and they should obey. I mean, this stuff is just there. It's buried, and if I feel the tension, that's what's there. Some expectation of compliance. Something left over about at the very minimum, about how I thought this interaction was supposed to go and how I think it should be going right now. And sometimes it's fundamentally, yeah, just this thought that Izzy should unquestionably do what I ask her to do. And those thoughts or assumptions are just like those stale crusts of bread in a dying man's hands. They offer some promise, and I think the promise is of certainty. I know how things are. I know how things should be. But fundamentally, that doesn't nourish anything. It doesn't nourish my relationship with Izzy. It doesn't nourish her development. And as long as I'm clinging on to those beliefs or those assumptions about how this is supposed to go, I can't creatively respond to the reality of each unique situation that we get ourselves into together. But if I can just acknowledge the discomfort that my own thoughts are causing, the grip of that thought almost always lets go. And then there's all of these great creative responses. And there is no power struggle. It dissolves. And creative engagement is possible. And I'm amazed and relieved at the possibilities that present themselves when I'm no longer grasping to the crust of belief of how things should be. That's the parenting part of the talk. Now the leadership part, which builds on that theme of the expectation of obedience. I want to read to you from a dialogue with Peter Senge and Margaret Wheatley, who are two organizational theorists and sort of some of the leading leadership theorists of our time. And Margaret Wheatley is particularly someone who I have a great deal of admiration and respect for. And this is from a dialogue they had in Shambhala, so it's specifically about the relationship of Buddhist practice and new thinking around leadership development. So this is Meg. This whole quest for obedience takes us in the opposite direction from life. One of the fundamental characteristics of anything living is the freedom to choose. The organism chooses whether to notice something, then it chooses whether or not to be disturbed. And if the organism chooses to be disturbed, it still retains the fundamental freedom to decide how it will respond. Obedience is not a natural life process. Peter. Living systems, by their nature, resist being obedient. Meg. And Peter, the consequent of not honoring life's intrinsic right to self-determination, is that when we ask people to obey and they do obey, they become lifeless. They shut down. They disappear. They become automatons. Peter. You get the obedience, but you lose the spirit. Meg. You lose the life. So what does organizational life look like if we acknowledge life's intrinsic right to self-determination? What if leadership has nothing to do with grasping towards an expected outcome? What if leadership has everything to do with inviting creative engagement? And these sound like abstract questions, but as someone who works with a lot of very large and very diverse groups, these questions have been my lifeline. This fall, I was working on a project with a network of 79 diverse community organizers, educators, and activists who are co-creating an alliance that uses popular education and the arts for social justice. And in another project, we folded 50 hip-hop and spoken words artists into an 800-person convening about an agenda for crime and justice for the state of Minnesota over the next 50 years. In a lot of these roles that I'm in, I'm somehow translating between a top-down hierarchy and a broad horizontal network, web. And when hierarchy meets network, it's pretty hard to predict what's going to happen. And if I grasp onto any illusion of control in these situations, I am done for. By holding on to any illusion of control, what happens is that I'm limiting my potential to creatively respond to whatever arises, and anything can arise. And these situations, they demand a creative response because we don't have a common language. We don't have a shared set of assumptions about how to get something done. And so everything that we need to co-create has to come literally out of the raw material of the current moment. And I remember I was in one of these meetings recently, and I remember saying, oh, gosh, what it would be like to just be in the nice, controlled environment of giving a Dharma talk. Because it's one thing to be in this environment as a 52-year-old white woman with a master's degree talking to you about how everything is unpredictable and changing. And here you are, and you're so quiet and attentive. And it's a whole other thing to be living that sort of unpredictable and changing reality in a room full of 50 activists who are voicing their contradictory and valid viewpoints while trying to somehow figure out how to collectively work together and move something forward. And that is absolutely living in the heart of impermanence, suffering, and if I have any illusion that I'm going to hold this together with my personality again, I'm done for. So it is the crucible of my practice. It is the edge of my practice to be in these rooms, and it is so amazingly liberating because there's no other way to get through. And if I grasp onto any assumption of how we're going to get through, how I'm going to get through, even from one moment to the next, I'm done for because I'm fighting reality. And in the words of one of my teachers, Byron Katie, that when I fight reality, I lose, but only 100% of the time. So, and I can tell I'm fighting reality when these are the kind of thoughts that start coming up. They're usually should thoughts, like, this should be easier than it is. Or, somebody should be in charge. Or, I know how to do this. I should be in charge. And with each of those thoughts comes this flavor of intense irritation. And then the thoughts, I know how things should be. Bottom line, I'm right. And in the most useful moments, that irritation itself is like an alarm going off. And that irritation itself is what alerts me that I'm grasping to some ideal of how things should be, and I am not acknowledging the current reality. I'm holding on to an idea that is not aligned with reality. And I'm inhibiting, by doing that, I'm inhibiting my own capacity for a creative response. This is just a side note. I just want to be clear that I'm not saying I cannot influence reality. I'm just saying that if I'm a whole lot more likely to have a creative result if I just don't fight with reality along the way. I want to come back to that metaphor for a moment of the clenched hand, and this time from the words of Martine Batchelor, who was a Buddhist nun in Korea for many years. And she writes quite a bit about the interrelationship between non-grasping and creative engagement, using the same metaphor of the clenched hands. So this is how she describes what happens when we grasp. She said, let's say there's this object here, let's say it's gold and diamonds, very precious. Or maybe it's like the greatest truth in the world, in the universe, and I've got it and it's mine. So I hold on to it, and with my hands, I hold tightly onto the object that is precious and that is mine. And if I do this for any length of time, two things happen. One, I get a cramp in my arms, because as soon as we grasp, we create tension. But something else happens that's even worse than that. If I grasp, I cannot use my hand. I'm stuck to whatever I'm grasping at. I stop my potential by grasping. This is essential to see. She goes on, so what is the solution? I would say that the meditative path is learning to open the hand so that the object can rest lightly on the hand. It can be there, it can be gone, and that's what I call creative engagement. Creative engagement is to come in contact, to encounter differently, so there is space in our experience, so there is the possibility of choice, potential, and creativity. In my experience, I do not know about yours, but just telling myself that I shouldn't grasp or mandating that I stop clinging doesn't seem to work. I have tried. I spent many years trying. And I realized that if the mind, after reading that this has like been like this process of writing this talk has been like a puzzle. It's like putting together these different pieces. And that piece from Meg Wheatley and Peter Senge about nature resists obedience, that if the mind is nature and nature resists obedience, no wonder my mind resists obeying any willful command to let go. Now that doesn't mean, again, that I don't have influence. And there are practices and things that I can do that keep me from being stuck and paralyzed and overwhelmed. So here are three things that help me. I think, as Martine Batchelor was saying, just sitting practice. That through formal sitting practice, we come to understand how release is possible. We come to see clearly that thoughts are not solid, they're not clay, they're not wood. They're just bubbles of activity that arise and pass away. And most importantly, we come to see that thoughts are not me and they are not mine. They arise and passing away due to causes and conditions. Through meditation, we come to see this clearly, and in seeing in, this insight, we gradually cultivate the freedom not to grasp quite so tightly. The second thing that is useful to me is in the moment I notice that I'm grasping is if I can really fully feel what that feels like. Really fully feel the tension and the discomfort of holding on. Not push it away. To honor that experience with my own attention. To really face what is going on and turn towards it. And sometimes, once the heart and mind come to know the cause and effect relationship between grasping and tension and suffering, then the heart and mind spontaneously let go. And the third sort of thing that I find helpful is inquiry. Certain kinds of questions that facilitate a release. And this is what Byron Katie's work is a lot about. And in her book, Loving What Is, she writes, "No one has ever been able to control his thinking, although many people tell the story of how they have. I don't let go of my thoughts. I meet them with understanding. Then they let go of me." And that actually feels much more coherent with what my experience is. In other words, that trying to use my will to let go of a pain-inducing thought may not work, but if I investigate that thought fully, letting go happens. And in Katie's words, the thought lets go of me. Well, I want to circle around back to that Mother Teresa story and to how the story ends. At the end of the story, Mother Teresa suggests to the sisters that we honor the crusts of bread. And to me, those words are a reminder to accept and to welcome everything, including whatever I've been clinging to. For the past year, I've been doing a sitting practice that I think I made up. Sometimes it's hard to trace back the source of something. But it's literally that as I sit on the cushion, I'm silently noting to myself everything that arises. But noting it with the word welcome. So for example, welcoming. Welcoming shallow breathing. Welcoming tightness. Welcoming hearing. Welcoming touch. Welcoming not knowing. Welcoming tightness. Welcoming confusion. Welcoming calm. Welcoming not knowing. And on, until the bell rings. I think that practice actually started with the word accepting. I think I did it for maybe about 6 months with just the phrase accepting. And then once there was a certain continuity of awareness and a certain continuity of kind of an inclusive welcome, then the noting falls away, and then there's just receiving whatever is the flow of reality in the moment. So, what have I learned from this practice, from practicing this way? And I think I've learned what a relief it is not to have to push anything out of my heart. I say that and it's just, I almost feel like crying. Not to have to reject any thought, any feeling, any sensation. To honor even those useless crusts of stale bread that I've been clinging to for far too long. Sitting there, just including everything. And that's what those words mean to me, Mother Teresa saying, we honor them. What is it not to have to? To reject what we think is useless. Is this another side note, which is, this doesn't mean I don't ever discern or choose one thing over another. It just means that I think from doing this practice that the decisions aren't driven by a visceral, knee-jerk, aversive reaction. So the decision has the potential of happening in an inclusive welcome field, which is a very different experience.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of how I've been practicing on the cushion. And I love this formalized ritual of sitting practice. And I think I experience it almost like a classical art form. There's the bell. There's this creative journey. And then there's the bell. Aesthetically, it's an ABA structure, compositionally speaking. And I've noticed that when I get up from the cushion, some part of me craves form. I crave a form that gives expression to the wisdom and the compassion of the Dharma. And a form that allows me to share that expression with others. And I think that form is somehow creating itself in the work I'm doing around leadership. It's been creating itself in my parenting and through this delight that I have with contemporary art. It's like the quest for a satisfying form or something. Stephen Batchelor, who just by sheer coincidence is married to Martine Batchelor, who I wrote about earlier, read some quotes from earlier. He's written quite a bit about how similar sitting practice is to the creative artistic process. And I said at the beginning of this evening that I wanted to be more explicit about these intuitive connections that I've been making between leadership, parenting, and contemporary art, creative engagement, and expressing the Dharma. Those five elements. And his writing was the missing piece in the puzzle of my understanding. So, I just want to read something from Stephen Batchelor. Awakening is only complete in the same way that a work of art is only complete when it finds an expression, a form, that translates that experience in a way that makes it accessible to others. I'll read it again. About six people nodded your heads. So in some ways, I feel like if I could just have put this on a little poster when you walked in here, and it would have been the whole talk. This was the missing piece for me. Awakening is only complete in the same way that a work of art is only complete when it finds an expression, a form, that translates that experience in a way that makes it accessible to others. Do you want me to read it again? Okay, there's about four more people nodding. yeah, it's taken a while for me to really integrate what this is. Awakening is only complete in the same way that a work of art is only complete when it finds an expression, a form, that translates that experience in a way that makes it accessible to others. I'm going to read some more of his words and see if that helps fill this out a little bit. The creative process of expressing the Dharma is not just a question of duplicating in words or in my mind in some other form, something etched somewhere in the privacy of my soul. The living process of understanding is formed through the encounter with another person, with the world. So, in other words, that what I was talking about these seasons of practice, that there's these seasons of intense practice, and then there's almost like this desire arises to engage the world in some way that is an expression of whatever understanding we get, just even sitting with ourselves a little bit. I'll continue. You've probably all had the experience, this is Stephen Batchelor continuing, You've probably all had the experience of someone coming to you in a state of distress and blurting out their problems, and you suddenly find yourself saying things that you were quite unaware you knew. The process of awakening is one of valuing and connecting with that capacity to respond in authentic ways to the suffering of others. The imagination is the bridge between contemplative practice and the anguish of the world. Say that one again. The imagination is the bridge between the contemplative practice and the anguish of the world. By valuing imagination, we value the capacity of each person, each community, to imagine and create themselves anew. So these different elements that I was sort of somehow intuitively had put in the same paper bag and were shaking up together, these elements of expressing the Dharma through contemporary art, through leadership, through parenting, and other forms of creative engagement. After I shook all this stuff up, I realized there's something to do with having the form to share our understanding with one another. And yeah. It seems like it's something about this, the role of imagination in how we make this bridge between the insight, what insight or compassion, what wisdom arises through our practice and the way we engage with the world. One of my favorite quotes is Frederick Buechner on vocation. Our vocation is where one's deep hunger, one's deep gladness meets the deep hunger of the world. So rubbing up against, and this is sort of a variation on that, where one's insight, one's wisdom, one's compassion rubs up against the deep hunger of the world. You know, each time that the Dharma has traveled some to another land, the Dharma has fundamentally transformed that culture, and the Dharma has been transformed by that culture. And it seems like as the Dharma has come, you know, sort of forming itself in the West and forming us, and we are forming the Dharma in the West, Buddhism, that this this investigation of the form that expresses an understanding of interdependence is something to do with the work of our time, and whether it's finding organizational forms or community forms, artistic forms, parenting relationship models or ways of being. It seems that finding the form that gives expression to this emerging understanding in the West, that perhaps we are not just these independent, autonomous beings, perhaps we are fundamentally connected. That seems like part of one of the gifts that we may be able to bring. I have some images that I wanted to close with, some slides, just a few sort of contemporary art pieces that I feel connected to. So I wanted to share these with you, and the big question is whether The projector will go back on. Let's see. Let's see. We have to clean the filter.
Yeah, clean it?
I don't know how. We can just leave it there. No, it's fine. Just told us to clean the filter. So. Great. Oh, no, we don't need to. So, this is a piece from a dear friend and colleague, Marcus Young. Are any of you familiar with Marcus's work? So this is a piece that Marcus has done in several cities, and here and in China and New York. And he is just walking down Nicollet Mall very slowly with a smile on his face and this robe and this umbrella. Well, my husband works in a building that overlooks Nicollet Mall. And he didn't know that this what was going on. He looked out the window, and he saw this man. And he actually sent an email to all of the family practice, the people in the Common Grounds Family Practice Program, saying, "I saw this beautiful sight. This man slowly walking down Nicollet Mall, and just so with this beautiful smile on his face, and this peaceful smile with these people bustling about." So, this is one of Marcus's pieces, and I think Marcus has done, but other pieces that are really about. I'm not going to just translate the work. I'm just going to show you a couple. Let's see. This is my notes on. No, that's fine. So this was, I was in Banff, and these were just some pieces that I happened to come across that for me had the flavor of the Dharma in them. This is a piece by Kay Burns, it's called Converse, and these people are standing on platforms, so you can get up there with a friend, and you've got these headsets on, and there's a video projector, and as you talk and gesture, the camera, somehow this equipment converts the gestures and the tone of your voice into vibration. It travels to your friend's platform, and their nonverbal expression travels up like a vibration through your body. So you begin to have a visceral experience of someone's nonverbals. If they do a sharp, forceful gesture, you feel it like from your feet all the way up through you. If it's a very gentle, sort of soft smile, all something as small as a smile, and you feel the ripple through you. That's one. And these aren't like, okay. This is a piece by another colleague, Li Mingwei, and these are three, it's called, I think, the Letter Writing Project. He builds these. They're made out of translucent glass and wood. They're, as you can see, they're quite beautiful. And they're writing booths. And people are invited to come, and there's desks and paper and pens. And you're invited in to come and to write a letter of gratitude or forgiveness or insight. And then you can either seal them and address them and leave them on the shelves, or you can leave them open so people can come in and read what other people have written. It's your choice. At the end of the day, he or a curator in a museum, if that's where this is happening, come and they collect the letters and they mail them. And we worked on this piece when he brought it here. It was part of a conference that was sponsored by Pathways around mortality, and I took the letters with people's permission and transcribed them onto dissolving paper, and then we read them aloud to the community and then dissolved the letters in front of the community. Let's see. This is a piece. What is this? I forgot to write it down. I can't remember her name. You'll ask me about it in a minute, and after I'm done, and I'll look it up. I wish I could remember her name. But she knits books. She takes books and shreds them, and then with a sewing machine, she sews the shredded little bits together, and then she knits them. This is one piece. It's like 12 feet by maybe 6 or 8 feet wide. And when they're, and this is, I saw this piece, it's when it's installed, it hangs on the ceiling and it drapes onto the floor. And then there are two huge metal bars that read almost like knitting needles. So she just spends hours and hours and hours knitting books. Now, I'm just imagining her knitting practice. And I'm also imagining that I will never see knitting the same way again. This is just a snippet of a piece. This is a huge circle that's on a wall. This is Anuguha Fakortas piece. And she makes these, like big circular mandalas made of the vestiges of things she can find in the pockets and the junk drawers of people she loves who have died. So she'll find, you know, in somebody's coat a piece of paper, and then with pins, she pins them on the wall and creates these quite beautiful three-dimensional mandalas. And it's really, for her, something of a statement about that a little scrap of a piece of a note about going to the grocery store will live beyond us. So in terms of something about impermanence. And then you can see very vaguely on the wall, she also stencils the wall with charcoal, so there's just this very vague, sort of barely discernible impression. Oh, this is Tina Segal. So is anyone familiar with Tina Segal's work? Tina Segal's work is, there's nothing that's made. Okay, so how can I describe this? Tina Segal has an exhibit at the Walker right now, but there's nothing written about it. It's only when you go into the gallery that you may discover it. So, for example, I had forgotten that this work was happening. I was at a friend's exhibit at the Walker, and I walked into one of the galleries, and there was one of the guards sort of standing there just sort of humming and singing. And I thought, how lovely, this guard. And I walked up to the guard, and the guard turned to me and said, "This is propaganda." And I thought, oh, it's not a guard, it's somebody who's crazy. And I better back up. And then I think she said, this is propaganda, Tino Segal, 2003. And I realized this is the name of the piece. So then there was a whole conversation. But these pieces are, I think that's all I want to say. So if you go to the Walker, you will just, right now, I think for the next, through March, these pieces are happening. And then this is the photographs. I wanted to show you the photographs that I took of Eli's hands. Thank you. to end with just one more quote from Stephen Batchelor, since he's the one who, it's his words that helped me sort of put the last piece of the puzzle to be able to see the picture. In the contemporary world, Buddhism encounters a culture that places a positive value on the power of the individual's creativity and imagination. It's interesting that in most Buddhist traditions, these things are not strongly encouraged. Or if they are, it's usually only within highly formalized settings. I like to think of Dharma practice today as venturing into a world of imagination, one in which each individual, each community, seeks to express and to articulate their vision in terms of the particular needs of their own situation. I like to think of Dharma practice today as venturing into a world of imagination, one in which each individual, each community, seeks to express and to articulate their vision in terms of the particular needs of their own situation. Buddhism would then become less and less the preserve of an institution, and more an experience that is owned by ordinary people in ordinary communities. I just wanted to add, like this one, ordinary people in ordinary communities. So, thank you. If you want to have a few minutes, if there's anything you want to ask or comments or just for a few minutes.
Yeah.
So anything that specifically had resonance for you or that had particular meaning? Or so. Yeah. I was just thinking when you said that, I had that sense of relief again. And unfortunately, the practice gives us a way to meet that anguish.
Yeah, you say there's not completed it for you.
Yeah.
This is what I was thinking too. At the moment, the form emerges from us, and as it were, merges with someone else's mind and consciousness, then we probably would have to let go of the other person towards it, right?
Yeah. It's interesting. Oh, yeah.
We'll never know what they're perceiving.
And I was just thinking about a lot of, and I feel like there's a whole other talk about what you just said and about the relationship of how Buddhism has influenced art in the last century and about how much that awareness of that the meaning is in the perceiver's relationship with whatever's been created. It's not inherently in the thing itself. It's our perception that makes the meaning.
Islamic fusion of color and pattern and so mm-hmm. forth. That in itself to me has meaning of just as well.
Yeah.
It's not just something like that kind of. Sometimes I wonder if like the use of materials that are very kind of earthy and so on and so forth has not become in itself something fundamentalism.
Yes, I think there has been a conversation going on increasingly in contemporary art that asks, what about beauty? And different forms of beauty. And the beauty of connection and the beauty of more classical. Well, thank you so much for the opportunity to what am I doing? I'm moving my head. I'm rounding it out. I'm rounding it out to look to really, what an incredible opportunity to take these different aspects of how I know that I knew were related to practice and really dive in and see what is it, what is the interrelationship. So thank you very much for that opportunity, and I think we get to move into tea and cookies.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.